Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak and I'm here with Tim Henney. Today in the program, we'll talk about resilience during the holiday season. Forget about those ways to bypass stress and emotional upheaval and just go straight to resilience. But how can we do it? We'll talk to Nefertiti Bruce. She's an expert on resilience.
And then Carl Ingwell. He organized a curious and somewhat unfortunate holiday event that took place yesterday at Trolley Square in Salt Lake. Santa was there, handing out candy canes as usual, but also handing out air masks. Carl is from the organization Clean Air Now and will talk to us about the dire air quality in Salt Lake.
Then we'll talk with linguist and author Ben Schott about his delightful new book, Schadenfreude. I don't even know if I said that right, but I'm going to act like I did. It's German words for the human condition. Now, the best thing about this book is that since reading it, Tim and I have begun making up our own German words, haven't we? I like that. And things like, oh, this meeting is boring. Where's the beer? Do you know how to say that? Do you remember how to say that?
Flughafen, Bergen-Sungs-Freude. How was that?
That was really good. Actually, that is a word in German that I got out of the book, but it doesn't mean this meeting is boring. Where's the beer?
Have we ever had an opportunity to say that word?
No.
No,
we
not
haven't.
At all.
That word actually means childish delight at being greeted at the airport. So these are all human conditions that when you flip through this book, you go, oh, yeah, I've felt that before. And it's really delightful. And I've never wanted to learn German before, but now I do. So there you go.
And I heard Chris Cherniak yesterday saying Schadenfreude, and he claimed to be actually familiar with that term. But I think he might have been making that up.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't.
Schadenfreude is actually a term that's used that means the pleasure that you experience at others' demise or...
That's exactly what he said.
Yeah.
He said, living in New York, he often experienced that.
That's very good. Well, we'll look forward to talking to all of these guests. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. Join us Thursday at 9 a.m. for Cool Science Radio.
We'll be speaking with Brighton Sampson, who is the curator for the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit at the Leonardo.
Then living in Utah means living around dinosaurs. We'll speak with the Utah State paleontologist about the latest dinosaur discovery.
That's Thursday at 9 a.m. on Cool Science Radio.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
KPCW's new classified ads are now on Facebook. Join the Facebook group KPCW Classifieds and Rideboard and see what's being sold, hired, rented, and searched for today. Post what you're getting rid of or what you're looking for free. Another service for locals, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, our first guest, Nefertiti Bruce, is an expert in early childhood intervention. She talks a lot about resilience and how children can build resilience, but she's also co-written several books even about resilience for adults. And now we thought that resilience would be a suitable topic for the holidays. And you see all of those self-help books and things out there about stress and how to avoid it. But we know that even the good kind of stress is pretty hard to avoid during the holidays. Right?
Yes.
And so Nefertiti is joining us to talk about resilience. And she's going to tell us a little bit about how we can use resilience to experience all the joy and thankfulness and all the goodness that comes out of the holidays. So good morning to you, Nefertiti.
Good morning to you, too.
First of all, I just like saying your name.
I am so happy that you can pronounce it. I can't tell you the number of times people have had trouble saying Nefertiti, and I always say to them, I know you just wish my name was Kim.
Yeah, well, coming from someone who has a one-syllable boring name, I love your name.
I appreciate that.
Well, first of all, talk a little bit about your background. You're an early childhood intervention specialist. That's what you do. And talk about what, how you were first interested in this concept of resilience.
Well, before I joined the Denver Center for Resilient Children team, I was a preschool and kindergarten teacher in Philadelphia. I was a master's degree level. I was Pennsylvania certified. But I will be very honest with you. I struggled. I thought I was doing a good job with the ABCs and the 1-2-3s, but I do not think I was doing my best at meeting the social and emotional needs of my students. And so through my struggles, I learned so much. I learned so much about me. I learned so much about children. And this concept of resilience, every time I stand before an audience now, I train them as if I wish someone had trained me. Because I think educators are being taught to put an emphasis on the cognition, which is fine, but there is such a social-emotional aspect of our children that we are missing. And so this all comes out of a struggle, believe it or not.
Nefertiti, how do we find ourselves in this position where have we lost traditions that would normally have instilled resilience in our children so that now we have to have intervention and early childhood development specialists and classes and workshops?
Well, I'm going to say this, and it's not as easy as I'm going to say, but it begins with us. It begins with conversations like the one we're having today. It begins with sitting and thinking about the traditions that may have been helpful for our growing up and trying our best to, we may not be able to change everybody and everything, but we can begin with our household and those that we love and care about. So, again, not as simply, it's not going to happen this easily, but it begins with us.
So does that mean that there's been a fundamental change in our family structure and at the household level that has resulted in children who are less resilient?
We have let it happen. Again, not putting priorities on things that may not be as meaningful to the everyday things. I think if we stop and think about it, and I'm just going to say for my own self, this is where I have learned so much about my own family and what we try to do differently is the world can say a whole number of things, but we have put a priority on family and friendship and love. And again, it's hard because the world doesn't always necessarily have a value on those things, but it is up to us individually and collectively to begin this process of going back to some of that good old stuff.
Okay. So what is missing? What aren't we doing that would create resilience? And, you know, first of all, in our kids, but also in ourselves, are we coddling ourselves somehow?
Oh, that's such a tough question because there is not one answer to what we're doing. We're being moms, we're being dads, we're being students. Our little ones are doing their best that they can oftentimes in schools. I don't think we're doing anything wrong. If anything, we've become more overwhelmed. There are things that, when we think about resilience, we think about a road, you know, and for some of us, the road has become so curvy. And navigating that road is challenging. And so what we want to do is, the research, there's a term called protective factors. Those individuals identified as resilient have protective factors. Now, protective factors can fall in our family. They can fall in our environment, but there are also some things within us. Like you'll be maybe interested to know that a sense of humor is identified as a skill related to resiliency. Mm. So simple laughter it's not going to make the road straight necessarily, but it can help you navigate a curvy road, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, I'm wondering, you know, when it comes to children, what's the difference between getting our children to be resilient and telling our kids just to buck up and man up and all those things?
The difference, we want to help our children have, we want them to fall down. We don't want to keep them from falling down because if you don't learn to fall down, you'll never learn how to successfully get up. And so when they fall down, we want to say to them, oh my gosh, this might have hurt, but you know what? Come on, let's figure out a way to make things better. We don't want to prevent the fall necessarily, but we want to help them learn to get back up. Some of the things that we do within our work at Devereaux is to teach children a skill called initiative. You know, with preschool children, when they're learning to tie their shoe, the first thing mommy may want to do is say, oh, let me help you. That may be a missed opportunity to help that child feel a sense of internal joy. Like, I did it by myself. Here, we're in North Carolina, and the weather is some days cold, some days warm. But when it's cold, let them put their coat on by themselves. It may take a few extra minutes to get out the door, but to raise resilient children is to help them feel this sense of internal, I did that. And I tell you, Lynn, there's a smile that you get from children when they've done things by themselves, that if we can create more moments like that, we are well on our way to raising more resilient children. Mm-hmm. Another simple thing is the loving care. Almost every piece of research that cites the life of a resilient person, that person names one or two people that have always been supportive to him or her. And so we encourage teachers to be that protective factor, but we also know mommies and daddies and grandma, grandpops, and the family, the village, can be a protective factor.
Nefertiti, you just mentioned Devereaux, and I know this is a little bit off topic because we want to get back to the holiday season and resiliency and dealing with stress, but quickly, could you just tell our audience about Devereaux? Is it university or school? And it's
sure.
Primarily sure. Focused on early childhood development.
The Devereaux Foundation was founded in 1912 by Helena Devereaux, who was a school teacher. And so at our national level, we provide clinical-level support for children, adolescents, teenagers who have social-emotional difficulties. We provide in-home support. We provide community-based support. And some of our students actually live on campuses. So we're in 12 states plus in Washington, D.C., but inside of the Devereaux Foundation sits the Devereaux Center for Resilient Children. You know, we believe that a student who's having a challenge at 14, he or she was once 4. And if we can do some more preventative things in his or her life, maybe we can increase the chances of having him or her to grow up more resilient.
Okay. Thanks for that explanation. And let's get into talking about the holidays. Now, you move sort of from children into adults, and I find that pretty interesting, just that, you know, the concepts that we can apply to raising our children, well, we really need to apply to ourselves. So listen to what we say, right?
we cannot teach it to them unless we first had it for ourselves.
That's right. Wow, that's a good one. So you have all these wonderful tips, and they're things that we might, if we thought about it, you know, we might say, okay, we actually do need to grow in gratitude. But just go over, a few of the tips that you think are most effective when we apply them to our lives during the holidays.
Sure. Well, I think I was preparing for our call today, and I thought, okay, if I only had a few minutes, what would I want our listeners to think about? And I think the growing in gratitude is a great one to begin with. You know, it's so easy to get caught up in who gets the right size or who wants this particular item or whose home are we going to celebrate, you know, all of those different things. But if we stop and just remember to be thankful for waking up, if we can go down to our refrigerator and it has something there for us to eat, we should be thankful. And oftentimes, if you do that, it can help you. You get more of what you focus on. So if you got up in the morning and everything went wrong and that's where you put your focus, you are more likely to get more of that. But if you can get up in the morning and say, all right, I'm a little tired, but at least I have a car that I can get into. At least I have a job where I feel respected and cared about, you know, growing in gratitude. And we can teach this to our little ones.
And
it can help us go back to the traditions of our families by helping our children to grow in gratitude.
And Nefertiti, is growing in gratitude something that is most important during the holidays? It seems to me like that should be a practice in daily life that you could carry through, maybe beginning your practice in the holidays and then trying to transcend into the rest of the year.
I think this would be great. Exactly what you said would be great. And when we wrote this piece, you know, it's here in December and the new year is getting started. And I actually thought about that. Definitely we can begin to think about these things today, but why not take these thoughts into 2014? You know, practicing now, but taking them into our everyday life. Every day we can do these things.
Are there other items that you focus on other than the practice of gratitude, which is a fabulous one? I kind of feel like I have practice of gratitude overload at the moment because I'm reading so many things about that everywhere on the web. It's just, you know, kind of coming at me right and left. But are there other practical practices that we should look at and try to implement into our lives?
Well, let's think about this one for the holidays, too. One of the second strategies that we thought about was asking for help. You know, going back to studying with children, there's sometimes children don't feel comfortable to say, Miss Bruce, I needed help, or Mommy, I need help with this. And so they'll struggle. And I often call that struggling in silence. And if we don't teach our little ones that it's okay to say, Mommy, I need help with this, or Daddy, I've done my best, but I need help, you can grow up to be an adult who tries to do everything. And then not only does it wear on your physical body, it wears on your emotional body. And everything that's good about the holidays is no longer good because you're not only emotionally exhausted, but now you're physically exhausted. And that can begin to affect our health. So one of the things we like to ask everyone to think about is asking for help. You don't have to prepare the dinner all by yourself. Ask for help. You know, if there's something that's on the list that you can just say, well, I wish I could, then just ask. And people will sometimes say to me, well, Nefertiti, they won't do it. I still encourage you to ask for help. Because you're not going to be any good to anybody if you're physically and emotionally exhausted. Dinner is not going to be any good to anybody if you can't enjoy it because you are physically and emotionally not feeling well.
That's a good one. So, Tim, would you do my Christmas shopping for me?
Is there something about being your authentic self and being able to say, no, Lynn, I won't do your Christmas shopping for you?
Yes. And with that awareness, Lynn knows, okay, I tried with that, with the Jeffrey TV set, but that didn't work. And so now let me think of it if there's someone else that I can ask. And that's what resilience is too, guys. It's about strategies. It is about determining what I can do to make this better. You know, you can get stuck. You know, I like to think about like sitting in a rocking chair. I'm moving, but I am not going anywhere. So resilience is about determining strategies, what I can do to make these things better.
Nefertiti, it seems to me that we're talking a little bit about kind of the how to address some of the symptoms that come from maybe more of a core issue of stress. And maybe it's stress that gets exacerbated during the holiday season and there's a fine focus or point on it. But it might be stress that exists throughout the year with a lot of people. So, you know, whether you're overwhelmed and tired and not asking for help and maybe not being able to focus on the right priorities are things that are kind of symptomatic of a greater issue, which is what creates the underlying stress in life.
Got it. You got it. And again, going back to the term protective factors, you and I and our listeners have to think about what I like to think of protective factors as an umbrella. The umbrella doesn't make all the stress that I'm dealing with go away, but it kind of shields me. And while I'm determining how I can maybe reduce some of my rain, I'm also thinking about what I can use to buffer me or assist me through these processes. And certainly the tips that we're sharing now are the beginning of the process. And it really is that the road to resilience is a process.
Right. Now, before we let you go, Nefertiti, I wanted to ask you also, one of your tips is to listen deeply. And this strikes something with me as we hurry around and we go to holiday, you know, gatherings and parties. And, you know, again, that overwhelm, it's nice to just come back to focusing on a conversation with one person and really listening to them.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And you are so right. With technology and, you know, you can come in. I can just imagine holidays right now. People are going to come into the environment. They're going to look beautiful. Things are going to smell great. But everybody's going to be on their cell phone or their tablet or something. And we don't listen deeply to one another. And so wouldn't it be great if we would just say, all right, guys, for the first hour of our dinner, and if we have to put some parameters on it, No cell phones, no tablets, no computers. We're just going to talk to each other, you know, and talking and listening. And again, if we think about this for our little ones, so many of us didn't have all of these electronic devices. So we do remember bedtime stories, and we do remember listening to grandmom and grandpa tell stories of their childhood experiences. Some of our little ones don't get that because of all of this technology that they have. Yeah. But we'll go back to what we said in the beginning. It's up to us. It's up to us to maybe make the suggestion that we're going to put all cell phone and electronic devices in a little basket by the door.
Right.
Maybe.
Those are all great messages. Nefertiti Bruce is an early childhood specialist, and she's also co-written a couple of books on the topic of resilience. And Nefertiti, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing these holiday tips with us.
Thank you, guys. I really, really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Happy holidays.
Thanks. Same to you.
And you're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be back. We're going to have a discussion about something a little less fun. It's air quality. Carl Ingwell, he will be our guest. He's started an organization. He's a University of Utah student. The organization's called Clean Air Now. Stay with us. We'll be back after these messages.
The Glitter Tent at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tent restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tent serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch, a proud supporter of KPCW. We understand the importance of local banking. We offer banking products from checking and savings accounts to business lending. Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch is located at 1225 Deer Valley Drive or online at grandvalleybank.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Celebrate Christmas at the Egyptian Theater with Kurt Bester's Christmas Spectacular Concert. Emmy Award-winning composer Kurt Bester and his band will perform traditional and original holiday favorites as only he can. Shows are December 23rd at 8 p.m. and December 24th and 25th at 6 p.m. Bring the whole family. Tickets start at just $29 and are available online at parkcityshows.com or at the box office at 328 Main Street. The Egyptian Theater celebrates the season as a nonprofit organization.
Support for KPCW comes from the Utah Olympic Park. Join the Utah Olympic Park in supporting our world-class athletes and their Olympic journey. Don't miss Utah's Road to Sochi featured event, the Nordic Combined and Ski Jumping Olympic Trials on December 28th and 29th. Free admission. Event details and VIP tickets available online at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, our next guest, Carl Ingwell, is a University of Utah student who wants just one thing for Christmas, clean air. So in October, just as the traditional winter inversion was setting up in the Salt Lake Valley, he founded the group Clean Air Now. It's a student-based group. They have a Facebook page that boasts about 500 members, and they've solidified the message that they're not asking for another task force or committee to discuss the issue. They're asking for action now. So the 12 Polluted Days of Christmas teams of Clean Air Now, they team along with groups Communities for Clean Air and Utah Moms for Clean Air. They're drawing attention to the failings of policymakers to act toward cleaning up the Wasatch Front's infamous inversion. And Carl is joining us to tell us why the group has hung banners from I-80 overpasses and even handed out masks for Christmas. And Carl Ingwell, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about how Santa was at Trolley Square yesterday handing out candy canes, but also masks. And tell us a little bit about that event.
Yeah, so we were at Trolley Square yesterday, and our goal was to raise awareness with Wasatch Front residents that just about the air quality, what's happening and what they could do to help. So we didn't just hand out masks and candy canes. It was a fun event. But we also handed out informational sheets about who those that visited us could contact and basically what they could do about the problem.
And Carl, how is that received when you're in Trolley Square and families are shopping and children are there and you're handing out candy canes and masks? It's kind of pushing a button in one way, but also being, you know, offering information. Is it well received, or do you get a little resistance from the people you encounter?
You know, it is well received. I think I've been out in the public talking about air quality with people for about the last year, working on various projects, and it is very well received. I believe there's a paradigm shift here in Salt Lake City, along the Wasatch Front in general, and people are starting to take air quality very seriously. And you can see that online. You can see that in public. If you go out and talk to people, you can see that on the different news media outlets. I believe that people are really starting to pay attention to this, and it's really becoming a top issue for a lot of people. What I think needs to happen now is that the public perception of air quality needs to translate into political action.
So, Carl, with this greater awareness, and maybe we're at that inflection point where we actually are able to see a transformation and a shift into action, what action can we take? Because, I mean, you think about it, and there's a natural phenomenon, the inversion, there's pollutants that go into the air. You know, we've got cars driving, we've got particulate matter, it's starting to creep up the valley into Park City. What actually can realistically and practically be done about the air quality in Salt Lake City?
Well, first of all, blaming this on the inversion is looking at it in the wrong way. Yes, we do get all this gunk trapped in the air, but we put it into the air first. So there is something we can do about it. You know, I think that it's a mistake for the Department of Air Quality to let industry increase their emissions 12% over the next 5 years under the state implementation plan that they've created, that they're required to create by the federal EPA to come in compliance with Clean Air Act standards. And you know, we always hear, and we're getting the message from the Department of Air Quality that what we need to do to solve the air quality problem is to step out of our cars and get out of our cars, take public transit, and that's great, it's cute. But what we really need is the infrastructure to do so. It's doing it is one, telling us to do it is one thing, and actually doing it is another thing.
Well, and Carl, aren't we also burning coal in a lot of our power plants around the state of Utah? And that, you know, right there is a major contributor to air pollutant. And then I think also along the same line of the coal is, I believe that you can still burn coal to heat your home in the winter in the Salt Lake Valley on green and yellow burn days.
Right. So just to clear something up. The coal that we use for our electricity along the Wasatch Front, most of that is burned outside of our airshed, which is kind of the general area where we share our air, basically. So burning coal doesn't have a huge direct impact on the Wasatch Front. It does affect air quality in other areas. I won't deny that. But along the Wasatch Front, not so much. Burning as far as fireplaces is a major source of concern for air quality in the Wasatch Front, though.
Okay, and you know, moving from coal burning into wood. You know, a couple of months ago, they came out with a study that showed that, you know, burning wood to heat your home is such a huge pollutant. In fact, many, many times more than we ever thought. You know, it's worse than secondhand smoke. It's, you know, right up there with coal is and, you know, we've talked to people from Utah Physicians for Clean Air, and I can't remember exactly how the ordinance goes. I mean, is it banned at this point?
There is a mandatory ban on wood stoves on alert days. basically. When the air is really bad, we do have a mandatory ban in the Wasatch Front on burning wood, with the exception of those people that have registered with the DAQ and wood smoke, or wood stoves are their only source of heat in their home. Those people are exempt from the mandatory ban.
So this makes me think about enforcement. What is the enforcement like? And, you know, like in Park City, we have a ban on, we have an anti-idling ordinance, but there's no enforcement. What's enforcement like?
I don't actually know the answer to that question. I haven't looked into what the enforcement is like with the Department of Air, or Division of Air Quality. I would assume, like any other government entity, they're kind of stretched thinly, and they're probably not checking every single home in the, along the Wasatch Front for wood smoke. I would like to emphasize that, you know, once we get to a red air day, that's when all the pollution, that's when we have an inversion event, and all the pollution's already trapped inside our valley, and we're already breathing nasty stuff. My emphasis would be more on, you know, cutting out some of the wood burning and cutting out some of the driving and just cutting out, you know, everything that emits air pollutants, more on the green and yellow air days than focusing on the red air days. Because once we get to those red air days, we're already stuck in it.
Exactly, Carl. I mean, that's what I was going to try to get to was, you know, by the time you get to an alert day, it's kind of too late. So what other elements do you see? What's the hierarchy of priority that you as a group, your group focuses on to try to implement now? I mean, what can we do now? You just mentioned driving less, cutting out wood burning. You've mentioned that the government's allowing a 12% increase for industrial pollutant over the next time period. Are those the three, top three, or is there a greater list that we should talk about?
Well, I think it's my opinion, if we're being asked to cut down our emissions, then everyone should pitch in their fair share. That's why I think that it's actually insulting to me that we are being asked to cut down our emissions as a populace when industry is just allowed to expand their emissions 12% over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically cutting down to give industry room to increase. And I think that's insulting. I think it's the wrong way of going about things. Like I said earlier, I think we need the infrastructure to be able to drive less.
Mm-hmm.
That's an improved mass transit system that isn't failing the people like the current one is. And more local business, less freeways, more of an emphasis on just keeping things local and being able to stay out of our cars.
What's the justification by the legislature for asking the general population to create additional space for industry to pollute and grow?
Well, I don't think anyone from the legislature would ever admit that they're doing that, and I don't know that they're maybe intentionally doing that. It's the Division of Air Quality that's sending out the messaging asking people to drive less. I don't know that you would sit down with anyone from the Division of Air Quality and say, are you asking people to drive less so industry can increase? I don't think they'd ever give you an answer to that question. But it is concerning to me that we are being asked to cut back our emissions in the state implementation plan. All the reductions come from mobile sources, cars, and area sources, homes and small businesses. And the only sector that is increasing is industrial pollution.
Hmm. So, you know, moving into the governmental discussion, I've seen that a lot of the groups, I think foremost among them the clean air, the Utah Moms for Clean Air, are really frustrated with, although Governor Herbert and his administration has declared this a priority, the task force and, you know, like you say, the sitting around making decisions about what we're going to do for the next couple of years is precisely what you're frustrated about. Does your group also kind of engage in this frustration? And, you know, and if so, what are you doing about that?
Well, my group is called Clean Air Now.
Right.
So you can imagine what we're after. We're looking for clean air now, and like you said, we've had enough of the task forces and you know the different U cares of the world and all of that. We're looking for realistic solutions that will cut up pollution now. What we're doing about that is we're getting out into the public, and we're working on a campaign this winter. There's a nifty little rule that I saw online about a year ago. It's called the 5% rule, and it basically the 5% rule states that a government can't act in opposition of its people if 5% of those people raise their voices on a certain issue. And so that's what we're trying to work on over this winter is get that 5%. That's contacting our government saying, we want clean air. We want clean air now.
Okay. And so you're basically out there with social media, Facebook page, and I assume it's just called Clean Air Now?
Yes. If you just search for Clean Air Now, it's all one word on Facebook. You can find us there.
Okay. Well, it's really heartening to see that a student-led, run, created group is happening. I think that you provide a very strong voice as the youth, and we wish you the best luck in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I talk to you again soon.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks a lot.
And Carl Ingwell is a University of Utah student, and he founded the group Clean Air Now. It's a student-based group. You can look them up on Facebook. You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
As the world evolves, so do our roles. At the Intermountain, Park City, Bonanza, and Round Valley Clinics, we have defined ours for you. I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and excited to announce that the Bonanza Clinic is now a full-time Instacare, exclusively for the urgent medical needs of our community. Our great partners at the Round Valley Clinic will now be the primary care experts. We are happy to provide expert care close to home. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, our next guest is a linguist and an author. He has written a new book. It's called Schadenfreude, or something like that. That was my best German accent possible. It's German words for the human condition. Ben Schott is also the best-selling author of Schott's Original Miscellany, and he's a very entertaining guy. And wow, this book about German. When the English language runs out, it so often turns to German. Words like angst and Zeitgeist, Wanderlust, and
Doppelganger.
Doppelganger, there we go. And all of these words we borrow from the German language because they elegantly convey the depths of human experience, like we just can't, apparently, in English, because we sound silly when we try to do them.
Lynn, did you see the YouTube bit on the German words compared to all other words for things like butterfly?
Yes.
I mean, if anybody wants to see a very funny YouTube on language, look up German language comparisons. I think that's
how German sounds compared to other languages. And that was pretty good, that one. And people who were German speakers took great offense to that.
Oh, I'm sure.
Very insulted. But it was pretty funny. And then here comes Ben Schott with this wonderful book. And I think actually it was designed to sit on the back of a toilet, right? Because it is a great one to leave in the bathroom. But I have carried this book everywhere with me since I got it, especially to meetings, because I can sit there and chuckle as I read this book. Well, we're going to welcome Ben Schott onto our show. He's a very interesting guy, and good morning to you, Ben, and welcome to the Mountain Life.
Good morning.
Ben, your book just cracks me up. I can't stop taking it to every boring meeting that I go to. And what was the inspiration for the book?
Well, I've always loved language, and I have some German heritage. And there's that moment where you think, you know what, there should be a German word for that. I wonder if there's a German word for that. And I decided if there wasn't a German word, we should create them.
Oh, these are created words. Okay. So the name of the book, and my German is just horrible, so I'll try. It's Schadenfreude, right?
Schadenfreude. So it's a pun on my name, Ben Schott, and the German word Schadenfreude, which is taking pleasure in other people's misfortune. Not a particularly pleasant emotion, but one I think we probably suffer from time to time.
Now, Ben, I think you must be redeeming the whole German language, especially after that YouTube video that I'm sure you saw recently. It was passed around on Facebook. I saw it. It was about, what was it, Tim? It was German. How German sounds compared to other languages.
It's true. There is something about German that we think of as pretty, shall we say, military. There's the Ich liebe dich, which is I love you. But the thing about German is that it's a lot more subtle and light and amusing than I think people think. I think there's too many World War II films that have sort of slightly changed our attitude towards it. So it was a way of, I hope, redeeming the language and also bringing it to people who use German words. I mean, we use angst, we use Zeitgeist, we use Schadenfreude, we use Doppelganger. We use lots of German words to describe emotions where English sort of runs out.
Well, Ben, the English language has always kind of co-opted and integrated lots of other words from other languages. That's one of the things about English that we, or certainly American English, that we've always done. And is that, I'm kind of curious as to why German is unique in that they seem to have been able to not integrate as much and create their own little language that still stands alone and sounds so different from everything else right around it.
It's very true. I mean, English uses a lot of loan words, and often they're words that fill a gap. So simpatico, for example, is a fantastic Italian word for someone who is simpatico, someone who you instantly click with, someone who just you just think we're going to be friends the moment you meet them. And so it's often words that sort of sum up these odd little human moments that the English language doesn't fulfill. But there's something about German. On the one hand, it's very serious. It's the language of Nietzsche. It's the language of Goethe. It's the language of Freud. It's that sort of philosophical language. And on the other hand, it's the language of kind of crazy Europop and war films and sprockets from Saturday Night Live. So there's this tension, and that's the joy, I think, of German. It's serious and frivolous at the same time.
And when you developed these words, were you sort of playing on things that you found already in the German language? There were sort of these terms that explained the human condition, and you just extrapolated upon that?
Yeah, and there are some of them that are very subtle puns in German. I think if I give you some examples, it might explain. So some of them, I mean, are very straightforward. There's one of my favorites is the word Mahlneid. Mahlneid is coveting thy neighbor's restaurant order. You're sitting there having ordered the salad, and your friend opposite gets the burger, and you're like, why didn't I? I should have just got the burger. And it's like, he always orders better than me. And that's Mahlneid, which is literally meal envy. So it's that moment, and you think you need a word for that. What is that sensation I always get?
Ben, I have to tell you, when I saw that word, I was like, I was so excited because I call it entree envy. So
that's very good.
Yeah. So I love that there's a German word I can see much more worldly when I use it, because I say it all the time. Oh, I've got to order what you ordered or I'll get entree envy, but I'll get Mahlneid.
This is true. So one of the other words is Kissenkühler Labsal, which is the ineffable pleasure of a cool pillow. And this is literally pillow chill refreshment. And you know that in the middle of the night, you turn the pillow over and it's this lovely, cool, fresh surface and you sink back and it's so delicious. And there needed to be a German word for that. And I looked through the literature because the book is also full of strange miscellaneous notes and footnotes. And Goethe had written about this. Marcel Proust had written about this. A whole host of authors throughout literature have written about that moment where you turn the pillow and it's ice cold and it's just incredibly reassuring and refreshing.
So, Ben, when you started to explore this, did you actually go back and look at the origins of the Germanic language and see how it compared to the Romantic languages and all the languages that they're surrounded by in that tight little European community over there and sort of try to figure out why German language is still so unique?
I think it's unique partly because of its compound structure. And unlike other languages, I mean, you know, you can create compounds in English. So bromance, for example, you know, a brother romance. But it seems inelegant and ugly and silly somehow. Lewis Carroll famously created portmanteaus like mimsy and slithy. And I don't know, they seem clearly childish and made up. But there's something about the German compound, something about Doppelganger or Weltanschauung, that has the depth of a Middle European culture and sort of has certain sort of seriousness and authenticity. And that's why I think it's a language that really suits itself not only to compounds, but also to sum up these emotions, to sum up these, some of them, I think, in the book are very dark and very serious, and some of them need serious German words to express these serious emotions.
You know, I have to say, I've studied the Romance languages for years and years, and I've always had sort of the penchant in that way. And I've never been too interested in the German language until now. And I think you are really doing a great thing for the language. What you're doing is it's so broken into, you know, small pieces, or I suppose you call that morphology, that it makes it really accessible. It's just so much fun.
Well, that's the joy. And there are, I mean, the risk of getting quite complicated. There are certain words that also are particular puns in German. So one of the words is Dornhüschenschlaf, which is feigning sleep to avoid unwanted sexual intimacy. It's like basically pretending to be asleep and you know exactly why you're pretending. Now, Dornhüschenschlaf is literally thorny lingerie sleep. Now, it's a pun on the German word Dornröschenschlaf, one letter difference, which is Dornröschen is the German version of Sleeping Beauty, who was surrounded by a briar of thorns to stop men approaching her while she slept. So Dornröschenschlaf and Dornhüschenschlaf are one letter difference. And a German will say, ah, I see, this is a pun on thing, but thorny sleep and thorny lingerie, this is the difference.
Oh, I just love that. It's so much fun. Well, I just want to talk a little bit about the format of the book, which is, you know, you give the German word and then you give the pronunciation that those of us who don't speak German are helped greatly by. And then you give the definition of the word. And on the other side, on the left-hand side of the book or the page, you give all these wonderful explanations. So talk about that just a bit.
Well, what I wanted to do was show that these sensations that you think of as very modern are actually very, very old. And some of them go back, you know, as I say, we quote Marcel Proust on The Cool Pillow. I'll give you one example. One of my favorite words is Dielen Nystagmus, which is corridor nystagmus, which is essentially when you're walking down a corridor and you see someone, you can't stare at them. So you look at them, then you look away, then you look at them and you look back and you have that your eyes are all over the shop. Because if you stare at them and you keep their gaze, they're going to like, this guy's going to kill me. I mean, only crazy people are going to stare at you if you walk all the way down the corridor. Now, there's lots of little footnotes on this, and one of them comes from a passage in Solzhenitsyn, where he's a prisoner in the Lubyanka prison, and he's being escorted down a corridor by a prison guard. And the prison guard clicks his tongue like he's calling a dog, and he has no idea why he's doing this. And then he hears another guard clicking his tongue. And when the other guard hears the guard, he pushes him into a little room so he doesn't see another prisoner in the Lubyanka prison. The idea being that you will have to be alone in this massive prison and you'll have no sense of fellow feeling with other prisoners. And so you think, wow, this is whole thing about corridors, and there's all these footnotes, and they lead on to other footnotes, and they tell the story about human existence. And that's the joy, I hope, of Schottenfreude, is you start off with the German jokes, and then you sort of delve into the footnotes, and you get lost in there.
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. Our guest is Ben Schott. He is the author of this book, Schadenfreude, German Words for the Human Condition. And Ben, thanks for your time today. But I have to tell you, there's one word you left out that you just simply must include in your next edition.
Okay, I have my pen open. What is it?
Okay, well, in English, we say invoking the powder clause. Now, what this means is if you live in a mountain town and you wake up and it's a work day, but there's, 2 feet of fresh powder outside, you invoke the powder clause, which is to say it's the knowledge that you'll call into work sick to go ski powder.
That is genius. I'm going to write that down.
Okay. Can you get back to us on that?
Definitely. I'll send you a memo.
Very good. Ben Schott, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And that was Ben Schott again. The book is Schadenfreude, German Words for the Human Condition. Ben Schott's also the best-selling author of Schott's original Miscellany. I've never said that word before, miscellany.
Miscellany?
Yeah.
Is it German?
I don't think so. Isn't it really amazing how, about words, even in our language, where there are words, I have this happen to me all the time, where you read a word and you've read it many, many times, but you're never quite sure how to pronounce it. So never in your life do you ever say the word out loud.
Right.
And then sometimes something will happen that you find yourself saying it and you realize, I've never said that word aloud before.
Right. And it doesn't help if somebody corrects you the one time that you do it. And you're like, oh, ow. Maybe there was a reason I never said that word.
The other day I was talking about something to my kids and I said omnipotent. Mm-hmm. And my son said, oh, that's how you say that word. It's not omnipotent.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, let me think about that. No, it's omnipotent,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, there's something about language and the development of language. I read this book that talked about the beginning of infinity, it was called. And you have to reach a certain level with language and with mathematics. Those were the two examples this author used that create a foundation for the expansion of knowledge. And until you reach that sort of critical mass in language, you can't express concepts and ideas, and you can't discover and you can't explore. And even funny little things like this book kind of push us in that direction.
Wow.
It's like the Eskimos with 1,000 words for snow.
Right.
And,
yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to express those concepts.
Right.
That is a good concept in and of itself. Well, we'll be right back. Stay with us. And of course, we want to thank our guests today, Ben Schott, along with Carl Ingwell and Nefertiti Bruce. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Lost and Found. Traffic, weather, and local stories. Only in Park City. Only on KPCW. This is KPCW Park City.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Tune in tomorrow for Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. We'll be speaking with the curator down at the Leonardo in Salt Lake about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, this is a very interesting show, and actually John Wells and I went to visit the show last week, the Dead Sea Scrolls, incredible 2,000-year-old scrolls that you can still make out you can still see the ink. It's all written very clearly. Very interesting. We'll also speak with James Kirkland. He's the Utah State paleontologist, and he'll talk about more dinosaur discoveries. They discovered one in Spain and a new one down in the Grand Staircase, Escalante Grand Staircase. Always interesting. And, let's thank our underwriters.
I've always wanted to go to the Leonardo. The Grand Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, San Francisco Design, Prudential Utah Real Estate, Peak Art and Frame, and Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa.